It gives me great pleasure to welcome our guest speaker, Jonathan Bull.
Right, well, follow that. I'll just sit down again, I think, after that. I'd like to thank the organisers for both Lee and Wigan for inviting me up here. I must have spoken here 4 months ago, something like that. Here in the North, I'd like to talk in the last fag-end weeks of New Labour as the Labour machine that came in 97 dies in 2010. I'd like to talk about old New Labour and their death throes. I was a grammar school boy in 1979 when Callaghan led them to defeat in 79, and people didn't know really what Thatcher was about, and Labour was tired and it was dragging itself to the polls. I think they wanted to nationalise the sunk ports. They had no policies at all, and they flopped down. We're seeing now the new Labour project that began in a wave of hurrah and glory in 97, with people believing that Blair and Brown were the new hope. It took several elections, indeed for most people, it took three elections, until they realised that Blair was an actor and a left-wing Tory in certain respects, and a front man, and a man who changed his opinion every other day and was equally sincere with you as he did so, and a man who's a sort of paid barrister who turns one way and says, I'm with you, and another way and says, I'm with you, and led us to war on the basis of lies, and has led us to bankruptcy as a nation and as a society. And Brown was sat next to him in every sofa cabinet that went on from 97, signing off on all the checks. And it took a long time for our people to see through Blair and to see through Brown. And at the moment, they don't know who to go for, because they don't like Cameron. He may well win. If he does, he'll only win by default and by a smaller margin than Thatcher achieved in the late 1970s. People will vote for him to get rid of Brown, because do you want five more years of Brown? Can you imagine what five more years of Brown will be like? It really would be like living in Broadmoor, wouldn't it? Or up here in Ashworth, you know? And he's, every time you look at Gordon, he looks older. One eye's up here, the other's down here. One of the lips is dropping. The chins get longer and more like a turkey. You know, he looked 55 when he started, and he looks 77 now, doesn't he? And yet he said on Woman's Hour that he wants to go on and on and on, and that he's no end to the bloke and no end to his government. It's grinding, statistically obsessed, and financially ruinous government. Our national debt is about £800 billion. The deficit is about £179 billion. These numbers dwarf most people, and they just turn away when they hear them. What it means is that every debt, in relation to every amount, was called in at one time, in one go. They couldn't be covered. And in reality, what that would mean is an end to all state pensions, and an end to all state benefit payments of every sort, an end to all injury and compensation claimants, in relation to people who worked in the mines and factories round here. It would involve an end to military service payments for those who fought in the Falklands, who'd fought in Iraq, whatever one thinks of that conflict, who'd fought in Afghanistan since and now, and so on. It would involve the fact that we have become a third world country, and the only reason those loans and those debts are called in to bring about that explosion is the spending of large amounts of money to stabilise an economy and its economic system underneath, which has been beaten and crushed and broken. Now, there's a degree to which some people are cynical, and are so cynical that they regard New Labour as a sort of tragedy which occurred to the society, which in some respects the society asked for. It's true that many of our people have adopted a tribal attitude towards voting. In the part of the country that I come from, people vote Tory almost without thinking. It's an unthinking blue wave vote, the way it's an unthinking red wave vote up here. Until people break out of these blocks, our people will return one government of one colour and one government of another. People like to think that the Tories and Labour are at each other's throats. They like to think that they have different ideologies. They like to believe that their personalities are different, the Browns, middle-class Scottish Erivis, and Camerons, an upper-class Englishman, that the one stands for people with money and the one stands for the working class and trade union power, that they represent different values. But have a look at what these parties actually stand for. Both parties are now in favour of global capitalism and the movement of large amounts of money around the world. Both are in favour of the casino version of it, which plagued our banks and the City of London. Quarter of our economy is controlled by the financial services sector, and which has plunged us in to this cascade of debt that now threatens to engulf and drown us. Both parties believe that labour moves around the world the way capital does, and labour is migration, and that's the new word for immigration. The reason that both parties believe in mass migration is to fill holes in the world economy, to keep wages down, to keep a vast subsection of the population either out of work or semi-employed or part-time employed or on the minimum wage or just above it and just around it. Everyone is replaceable. The churn is immeasurable. 4.6 million people have come to the country and gone in the years that New Labour have been in, because people flow through, stay, stick a bit, go, reclaim, come back. And the number of people who leave the country increases at every moment. In the last 12 to 13 years, about 3 million people of our people, and everyone knows who they are, have left the country to Spain, to Australia, to Canada and elsewhere, probably never to return. And they've left because they see no difference between the Tory Labour and Liberal machines. The Liberals are the orange yellow bit stuck in between the red and the blue that provide the ideas for both other parties that claim to be uninfluenced by them. So both of them agree on movement of capital, movement of labour. Labour say there should be virtually no restrictions on immigration, and it appears that none too artificially, but quite deliberately. New Labour between 1999 and 2003-04 opened mass immigration and opened it again and opened it again. Some say, the Sun and other organs of expertness allegedly, that it was even a conspiracy to do so, that they wanted to rub the nose of the right, by which they meant the Tories, in it, that they wanted them to see the reality of multiculturalism in and around them. You didn't need to see multiculturalism in and around us before 1997. You could see it in Birmingham in the 1970s. You could see it in inner Glasgow in the 1980s. You could see it in inner Bristol in the 1950s. You could see it in southern and western London in the 1960s. You could see it in inner Cardiff in the mid to late 1980s and early 1990s. You could see it in Manchester from the late 1960s. I spoke in Leicestershire recently. Leicester is the first ethnic city. It is the first city where white, European, British people, English people are in a minority. They're 48, 49%. Add all the other groups together and they have little in common with each other, particularly the Asians, many of whom committed genocide against each other in 1948 when India collapsed. Yet aggregate them all together in Leicester and there are a majority. A majority. We're now a minority in a major English city, and Birmingham will be soon. And every other city will go. If you live in Norwich, you'll have to wait 20, 30, maybe even 50 years until it happens. But there's a degree to which it's happening. The cities are changing. The cities are becoming destinations of change. They're becoming second, third, fourth world zones. People pass through them. 2 million British people go into London every day, leave as quickly as possible when the working day is over, because they don't want to stay. Why don't they want to stay in what was once the capital of an empire that ruled a quarter of the world? They don't want to stay because large parts of inner western, eastern, southern and northern London do not resemble anything like the city that they knew when they were young. The whole phenomenon of the Essex man, so-called, is the large number of Cockney East Enders who've moved out of the city to get away from the extraordinary changes which have occurred. Why else do you think in Tower Hamlets is the respect candidate returned to the House of Commons? He supports Saddam Hussein's Iraq before it was exploded by American power, supports Libya, supports Arabist causes all over the world, because the people who live in Tower Hamlets now, in a complicated sort of a way, have more in common with those causes than they do with the causes of the people here in Wigan or in other northern towns. What's happened to the society is that the elite has let the population go and looks elsewhere for succour and for support. Big capital and big unions are combining in a world economy with a would-be world elite that sees countries like England and Britain as stepping stones to their own careers. In particular, Blair is very like this. First, leader of the Labour Party, leader in opposition, then leader in government, then a leader of Britain, leader of possibly the European Union, but that was shot out of the water because of his support for the Iraq War. Then he was seeding for the idea of being head of the UN. Head of the world, almost, in a slightly megalomaniacal progress. Although Blair wasn't too confident when he appeared before the Chilcot Inquiry, which, for those who don't know, is about the Iraq War and how we got into it. The Iraq War has many causes and has been a disaster from beginning to end. How many fought in it fought bravely, but doubtless in a couple of years, some of them will be on trial. Indeed, the briefs for the trial of quite a few officers are already being prepared, because not only are you fighting against Mujahideen in the alleys of Basra in southern Iraq in front of you, you've also got tricky human rights lawyers behind you who are watching for the slightest slip or indiscretion or beating of the occasional looter and that sort of thing, which in this vortex of hot struggle will always go on. And if there is some sort of evidence, people will be arraigned before the courts. So we go to war at America and, to a certain extent, Israel's behest. We then engage in silly little witch trials of our own men for prosecuting wars a large section of the population didn't support in the first instance and don't support now anyway. 75% say that they don't support those wars. These wars are very silly on many fronts, but the major one is you do not allow millions from the societies that you may then tend to invade at a later date to settle in your own country and then attack their societies, cultures, structures, states simultaneously. You either say, no, you don't come in, or you come in and we don't go to war, or you don't go to war, but you don't engage in a messy combination of all of those variables. Liberals believe that everyone's the same and everyone can come and stay and we can all get on because things that have existed in human life forever, tribal identity, group identity, individual pride, gender difference between men and women, conflict orientation, the struggle between peoples that has characterized man since the beginning of organized life, these things can be wished away as conceits, as reactionary views that progressive people don't hold. Biology will trump all of that, because all humans come out of nature and go back into it. And the problem that we face is that the liberal ideas that govern our elite, whether they're in the Liberal Party, the Tory Party, or the Labour Party, they all have liberal views. They all have liberal views. They all believe mass immigration is marvellous. They all believe the abolition of the death penalty is marvellous. They all believe that the European Union is something which should be supported. They all believe that these flags that you see around this auditorium are things that are just temporal, that just reflect the fact that this is a zone, it's no different to any other country in Europe or further afield. They have no pride in being English. They have little pride in being British. They have little pride in being a white European. They support walls all over the world, but at the same time, these people themselves lack the martial spirit. The liberal elite that rules us is leading this country slowly to ruin. And by the middle and to the end of this century, we will be in a version of the third world. There are white children in Hackney, in inner North London, who are 2 to 3 per class out of 30 to 35. Their culture will be totally disprivileged. They are an ethnic and a racial minority in those areas. They will never, ever see those areas change, at least in their early lifetime. When Black History Month is rolled out in Hackney, in central North London, as it is across London and across the big cities, paid for by your money here in Wigan and Lee and elsewhere, every white child learns it. And they're a small racial minority now in these areas. No white history for them. And if you don't have a coherent history that relates to you, you don't have a presence. And if you don't have a present stroke or present at this time, you don't have a future. And if you don't have a future, then there is really nothing for it. And it will merge in gradually into what is coming, which is a large multiracial world splurging across what was once the West with a small elite that will include the elites of China and India and elsewhere. We're living in 2010. In 1910, we ruled a quarter of the world. There were many problems, but we were in some respects a great country. That's why we're called Great Britain. Macmillan wanted to do, he was a premier in the 1950s, he wanted to do away with the term Great Britain because he thought it was out of date and reactionary. We're still called Great Britain. When you get your purple, Ribena-coloured European Union passport, remember the old English, British passport was blue, was big. Well, you could hold it in your hand. It went round the hand. The European Union passport's a tiny little thing that looks like a joke sort of passport, something you get out of a Waddington's game at Christmas. This is what this country's been to reduce to, a province of the European Union. And yet we're still with America as we dither on the margins of Europe. And that is because we're besotted with liberal ideas, and it's because we have a liberal elite who have misruled this society since at least 1948, when the Labour Party passed the Nationality Act, which allowed the first waves of mass migration from the Third World to come into this country. Again and again and again, on issue after issue, economic, social, racial, anthropological, cultural, in relation to Ulster, in relation to European Union integration, in relation to crime and social disorder, the country has been let down and broken down generationally, again and again. Cameron talks about broken Britain, and he says that the society is broken. He talks about certain cases, such as the Bulger case, which has come back into the news recently, as exemplifying the fact that Britain is broken. Well, he's right, Britain has a strong streak of crack running through the surface of it. There's a breakage in British society to which the Tories manfully contributed in the 1980s, when in the height of a massive depression they deflated and they cut public spending at the height of the curve as the depression went down, and unemployment in areas like this and right across the north of England and right across the Midlands went from 2.5 to 3 to 5 to even 8 million. The Tories talk about a broken Britain, and yet they devastated large parts of the north of England, such as here, in the 1980s, which is not being forgotten here. It's why the Tories are so hated in these areas, and why, although many people are now receptive to right-wing views, they will never accept them in a Tory manner. I want to say something about the Bulger case and the fact that people think it's exemplificatory of the country's decline. Here you have two psychopaths, Venables and Thompson. Both of them are children. Both of them take a baby from a Liverpudlian or Bootle shopping centre and murder him in the cruelest and most sadistic manner possible. Both of them then get 8 years in a special unit. Both of them are then released ahead of time and contrary to what the public's instincts want. My general view is that it would have been illicit to hang Venables and Thompson when they were children. That's done in China, it's done in Iran, it's done in North Korea. We're not those sorts of societies. However, to hang them both when they were 18, instead of releasing them into the public, irrespective of Venables' return to custody, I think would have been a morally efficacious thing to do. Both were sentient, both would have been adult, both would have spent 8 years in prison. Both would have had to dwell upon the prospect of what was coming for them. both would have known and at least understood, insofar as psychopaths can, the reality of what they have done. I know people who've worked at Broadmoor. I know people who've seen the files about the injuries that were inflicted upon that toddler. I know people who do not wish to talk about the nature of the murder that was committed. I think their execution when they were 18, rather than their release into the general population and their giving of new identities, is a good thing. Liberals believe that they can be cured and redeemed because they believe it, that love conquers all, and that if only they'd had better childhoods, they would have had better outcomes. The victim is nearly always off stage by the time this sort of discourse begins. They believe that human nature can change. In the nature of these psychopaths, it cannot change. Even if they don't commit new crime, they will not alter, because psychopaths are born the way that they are. What's a psychopath? We're getting slightly off the message of normal politics here. But psychopaths believe that a human life's that of an ant and can be stamped on just in one go. Psychopaths believe that rape is normal sex. Psychopaths believe that destruction is goodness and morality. Psychopaths in Broadmoor or Ashworth, which is the equivalent hospital up here, fight against each other all the time, despite all the psychotropic drugs that they're on, in order to secure who's the most dominant, the most vicious, who's killed more, who's eaten the ones that he killed. These people can't be cured, and it's only false liberal theories that think that they can. And the way to deal with these sorts of things is to close Rampton, which is the Midlands equivalent, or Carstairs, which is the Scottish equivalent, or Broadmoor, which is the most famous hospital of this sort in the world, and is the southern equivalent, and Ashworth, where Ian Brady, the Moors murderer, still is, which is the northern equivalent. You have to execute these people and close these institutions down, because there is no hope for them, and there is some recompense for the families of their victims if a solution such as this is effective. Now, if this was done, the majority parties scream in outrage about the human rights of these people, about the civic nature of the society, about being uncivilized by supporting the death penalty for individuals of this sort. But in actual fact, the instincts of the population here are right, and the liberal feelings of the elite are incorrect. Because although the people feel leaderless and they feel powerless by virtue of what they see beaming out of the television on a nightly basis, most of their instincts about the matters that I've brought up in the early parts of this speech are true. Most people want to get out of the European Union. Most people would like Britain and England to be proud once again. Most people are sick of Labour, but don't want the Tories. Most people would like a government that has a sense of social justice, but a deep sense of social conservatism, tied together by patriotism. Most of us would like to unshackle ourselves from the United States and their wars across the world. Most of us would like this country to be different and better. We would like it to be less crime and drug-riven. We would like it to be more white. We would like it to be safer for older people who've often served this country well in past generations, and many of whom are now frightened of the society which is growing around them. Why should they be frightened? Why should older people worry about going into a town or a city centre after 6 o'clock, Friday or Saturday evening, even if a lot of it's in the mind? Why should they be worried? These are people who built this country. Everyone's got older relatives. Everyone has a mother and a father. Everyone has a family. Everyone has an extended family. Why should people be frightened in their own society of jobbery and of crime? Crime needs to be punished with severity, jobs birched and put in the army. These are the sort of things that you need to do if you want to turn this country around. If you want it to go down and further down into a liberal pit and to be a pretty much a rubbish dump by the end of this century, continue on the road that you're going down. But if you want it to turn around, people have got to do something radical. Rather than just talking and drinking, they've got to vote. They've got to get out. They've got to leaflet. They've got to electioneer. They've got to come up here and make a few speeches. and understand all the laws which have been passed to prevent people having free speech on these matters and find a way around them. We're a people of wit, we're a people of conceit. In the Elizabethan period, we were one of the wittiest people on earth. We should be able to find a way round these laws which have been passed to gag us. Every time I speak, I'm aware there's 10, 12, 15 laws that have been passed just under New Labour alone, on race, on culture, on religion, on gender equality, on transsexual equality, on sexual equality, on sexuality equality, on every form of equality going, in order to prevent people from saying what I'm saying somewhat obliquely about the nature of the problems that face this society. One has to speak obliquely because of the laws which have been passed, beginning with the Race Act under Wilson in the late 1960s, becoming the act which created the Commission for Sexual and Racial Equalities in the early 1970s under Wilson again and Callaghan later, then mushrooming under Blair into this whole bureaucracy, which is now headed by Trevor Phillips. Trevor Phillips gets £100 million a year, £100 million a year of your money, to run this bureaucracy in the middle of London, which has imposed the idea of ethnic Britons, in quotation marks and without the quotation marks, joining this organisation for reasons of equity, to fulfil European Union statutes, for reasons of human rights law, and so on. The party, realising it was on a losing wicket, fought back, but moved back, the way a retreating army under heavy and percussive fire has to do, taking a few losses and trying to make the best of what is a bad situation which is designed to divide it and to lose it money. Phillips won't succeed in his endeavours, but he knows what he's doing. And his endeavour is that people in Wigan do not have a voice. People in Lee do not have a voice. People have no voice other than Labour, and if they don't like that, they don't vote at all. This is the idea. And if they get stroppy, there's a new working class in Asia and in Africa and in Polynesia and in Eurasia and in Latino countries of Latin and Central America that can be brought in their stead. 20 to 60 constituencies are already controlled by the ethnic vote. 80% and 90% of Afro-Caribbeans, persons of African origin, diaspora blacks, whatever, vote Labour. 90% if they vote at all. Of Asians, it's 50 to 70% always vote Labour. The ones who don't are primarily alienated because of wars that they fought on Israel and America's behalf against the Islamic world. These are ethnic blocs that vote Labour. That's why the Labour candidate for Bar King in East London says she doesn't care about white working class people. She says we don't represent them anymore. They can go away. This is the Labour Party that she is representing. The Labour Party that was set up to represent such people in 1900 was set up by the Trade Union Congress, who financed the Labour Representation Committee, out of which the Labour Party came. That's why people like around Wigan and Lee are so fanatically loyal, even now, in part, particularly older people, to the Labour Party. There are many people around here who say, I agree with what he's saying, sort of, but I'm Labour, you know? Labour till I die, cut me open and it's red. Red is the colour, Labour forever. And yet Labour have betrayed the people in these areas, with the exception of social welfare, on issue after issue after issue. And still people vote Labour. And still they go on returning Labour MPs in Wigan, in Lee and in other places. It's only when they stop doing so, it's only when an explosion occurs, such as took place in the European Union Parliament a year or so ago, that people turn round and notice. This society is changing. In the European Union elections, 1 million people voted for the British National Party. 2.25 million voted for the New Labour Party. Labour is the governing party, and they only got 2.5 times what a radical party, which is demonised by every other tendency of opinion, and was able to achieve. When Labour politicians sit in Whitehall and they look at that, they realise that their own core electoral base is turning on them. They realise that they're in danger in their core areas. No one's going to vote Tory here, but a large number of them may well vote British National Party and put people in. And as Blunkett said when he was Home Secretary about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, wherever that party wins, the present setup is in danger. Britain may be broken, but the breakers of Britain themselves break when this party wins, particularly when the former leader of the National Front, Andrew Bronze, was elected to the European Parliament. The nausea amongst New Labour supporters that that thing created, they were choking with the emotion of it, the negative emotion of it, the night of that victory on radio and television, beamed across the world. This is the impact that these sorts of votes can have and ought to have from now and into the future. Many British men are fighting tonight in Afghanistan. They're fighting in Helmand, which is a desert in southeast Afghanistan with a jungle in the middle of it. You go out of the desert and into the jungle and you're into full-on violence. The violence that they're experiencing is equivalent to the severest fighting of the Korean War, which the Gloucester Regiment engaged in the early 1950s with some detachments from Ulster and elsewhere, and of course South Korean and American allies. They were fighting against Maoists from China and North Korean troops who would behead any prisoner and cut their head off and cut their eyes out. That's what war involves. That's what sometimes happens to people if they're captured by Taliban in Helmand. Now, this war is unwinnable, and our politicians know that it is. And they believe that if we leave now, Al-Qaeda will come back, this network that flew the planes into the towers and into the Pentagon a decade ago and changed the nature of the world. However, my contention and the contention of this party is you don't destroy Al-Qaeda by bludgeoning a third world state like Afghanistan, where they're born gun in hand, where they fight for every valley, and where, as the Berkshire Regiment proved in the 1890s, never mind now, they are basically can't be conquered in their own territory. They move away from you if you're too powerful. They put roadside bombs, today's weapon of choice, in the way, and then they come back when you've gone. The way to defeat these insurgent movements is to get amongst them with special forces, is to know where they are, is to destabilize them using the special boat service and the special air service. These are the people that you use. You don't invade a country. You remove yourself. And if they threaten our streets, and if they bring their bombs and bullets and explosives here, we make sure we have special forces to deal with them. That's how you fight irregular, paramilitary, guerrilla war. You do it cleverly and with pluck, rather than in some bludgeoning sort of a way, which at its worst replicates what the United States did in Vietnam, mass terror bombing and the rest of it, and then you lose, and then you leave humiliated, as they were forced to, in a war that's rarely mentioned now, I notice. We must fight our own wars that are in our interest, not in America's interest. We're not a satellite of the United States. We should be a proud and independent, middle-ranking country. Argentina is growling again because more oil than is in the North Sea has been discovered off the Falklands, thereby proving those dissidents that said 30 years ago, when I was a very young man, that the Falklands War was fought about fuel. The Falklands War couldn't be fought now because we don't have the Navy to do it, by virtue of the fact that we've declined as a society to such a degree since then. But all the men who fought, 16,000 men, have fought under our colours in the micro wars since 1945 and have perished doing so. The purpose of this party in this era, not 45 and before, but in the era that we're alive, the purpose of this party is to make sure that those 16,000 deaths were not in vain and that their widows and relatives were not left in want for nothing at all. That these flags that you see around you in this auditorium this evening, here in the north of England, mean something. That when a soldier is buried and his casket is draped with these symbols, it actually means something to those who are left and who will follow them, and who will hope to see a government which represents them in the future. A government which will be more British, more glorious, in some ways kinder, in others harsher than that exists at the moment. In all areas of life, Britain is in decline and needs a shake-up. And this is the only political party which envisages it in a manner which is possible for us at this time. I ask you to get out and leaflet for this party, to help to pay for its election expenses in this night here in Wigan, I ask you to give your support to the candidates who come forward to stand in Wigan, Lee and elsewhere. I ask you to make sure that when the ballot is before you, you vote for the British National Party, your parents do, your immediate family does, your extended family does, and you tell people at work and you tell people socially that you voted for this party. You don't say that when somebody asks you and you did vote for British National Party, no, I voted Labour, or I don't know, I've sort of voted for some independent, or I didn't vote anyway, or it's raining, I didn't turn out, and that sort of thing. You say with a degree of pride that you voted for this party. You voted for Britain's future and for its children. Think of those children in Hackney. Think of them too white to a class that is not. Think of what that will be like 50 years from now, 70 years from now, 130 years from now, if no changes are made. So there's a degree to which Wigan will follow where Hackney has gone. There is no escape. Each area of the country lags in various ways, 30 years, 50 years, 40 years, 20 years, behind the Leicesters that I talked of earlier. Don't sort of pity the people of Leicester. Look to what has happened there as an example, and Birmingham as well. If anyone wants to see what this country has become, go to the centre of London for a day, it's only a day trip, stand in Piccadilly Circus, look at the 9 elevators going up and down. Look at the fact that 90% of the people on them are from elsewhere in the world, and see Britain's future demographically there, unless something is done. The Tories say there will be a cap. It is meaningless. Meaningless. They've said these things for 40 years. When Enoch Powell made the speeches in the late 1960s, the whole world heard, and England heard. Here was a man, he was an academic, he was an intellectual. Many of his audiences didn't, they, in all truth, have that much in common with him. But they understood instinctively what he was saying. When soccer fans chanted his name throughout the early 1970s, everybody knew. Everybody knew what he meant. And isn't Enoch Powell right? Wasn't he right in what he said?
Excuse me.
Wasn't he right in what he said about the nature of this country and what would happen in relation to the next couple of decades? He died a while back, but the future which is coming to bear upon us all here in Wigan and Lee and elsewhere is such a one that his memory, and the memory of the people of the National Front in the 1970s, and the memory of the people who founded the British National Party, many of whom are more radical than the present policies of this party, because this party has had to moderate to adapt to the circumstances of the democracy in which it finds itself. I want the BNP vote in this election, which will be 6 weeks from now. I want it to be bigger than last time. I want it to be bigger than last time in the north of England, in the south of England, in the east of England, in the west of England, in Scotland, in Wales, even tangentially in Ulster. I will ask you for the last time to put your hands in your pockets later this evening to support this party so that it can run candidates to get bigger votes in the three constituencies around you. Thank you very much. Thank you.